Welcome, and indeed we did reschedule this matter, and we hope, Mr. Thompson, that you are feeling better today, and we are glad to have you both present. This was originally scheduled on September 16. It's file A210434 in the matter of the welfare of the children of AP and DL parents, and you should both be able to see the box in the corner of your screen, which will have the timer. Right now, you just have the smaller numbers, but the 15 minutes for appellate's counsel will be identified, and same for respondent's counsel. And then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal on behalf of the appellant. And so if anything happens while this proceeding is happening from the technological standpoint, the marshal will freeze the clock and we'll reconnect you if that becomes an issue. Also, any separate recording is prohibited by judicial branch rules. We will, though, however, have your electronic recording of this available on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. And so with that, and what we wish for you to do is identify yourself before you begin your comments. And so, counsel for appellant, if you would identify yourself, you may do so and then proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Bill Thompson. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Derek Blockwier. This is a matter that stems from a termination of parental rights action filed in St. Louis County. At that point in time, the district court determined that Mr. Lockwier's parental rights should be terminated on a number of different levels. And we have filed the brief contesting that. I know a lot of that is already cited in my brief. I have no doubt Your Honors have already reviewed that brief. So I'll try and limit my discussions here today and be glad to answer any questions that you may have. As the court's likely aware, a number of the elements of a termination of parental rights overlap. As you can see in the statute 260C.007, a number of the subdivisions all rely upon what's called reasonable efforts. In this particular matter, three of those, B2, B5, and B8, all reference the idea that St. Louis County must make reasonable efforts to reunify the child with the family. In this particular matter, Mr. Lockwier takes exception to the fact reasonable efforts were not made and doesn't believe that the court reached the appropriate conclusion.
Mr. Thompson, reading the record and on the reasonable efforts factors, it appears that there was meeting set up, phone calls, phone minutes were provided to him, referrals for assessments. Are you acknowledging that he did not avail himself of those services that were offered?
Judge, the question in this particular, at certain times, that is correct.
The court only has to find one condition exists in order to support the termination of parental rights. So when we're talking about the fact that this child has been in an out-of-home placement since May 29th of 2019 and no contact from dad by that point, to me it seems you have an incredible uphill battle to show that there was meaningful contact. So my question to you, I do have a question. My question to you is, what did your client do to have contact with the child?
Well, the problem there, Judge, is the fact that contact with the child isn't necessarily up to Mr. Lockwier. In a child protection matter, that is left.
Well, a parent would normally send a birthday card, a note, or something, acknowledge holidays. Are you saying he didn't have to do any of that on his own, that he has no responsibility and the county needs to spoon feed him then the relationship with the child?
Well, Judge, I don't necessarily would use the term spoon feed.
Well, he's had no contact with the child since May 2019. So what I'm asking you is what did he do of his own volition to have any contact at all with the child?
Well, there's two separate points here. There's one, the brief periods of time when Mr. Lockwier was not incarcerated. And during those times, there's nothing in the record that I could point to that says Mr. Lockwier tried to reach out to have contact with the child.
Can a person in prison send mail? Yes. Did he do anything of that nature?
There's nothing in the record that would state that, but even if Mr. Lockwee, he would not have access to just mail something to the child because the county would have custody. Any mail or anything that he would have to do has to come through the county agency. It's just the nature of a child protection matter.
And I understand a child protection, the county is obliged to make reasonable efforts, but in some regards, it's hard to have the county under this criticized for not making efforts when volitionally there appears to be opportunities for your client from prison.
But Judge, I'm not even sure my client would have had the address for where to mail any of these types of things or the phone number, because a lot of times these things are kept confidential. I understand the court and the point that the court is trying to make. I have
one. And I appreciate your response, because if the county does not provide him with that information, that's a very important responsibility that they have.
And Judge, I would point out too, I mean, one of the issues, certain types of the contact that you're intimating, if the child was like 14, 12, 10 years old, I think would make a lot more sense. But in this particular case, we're talking about an extremely young child, a newborn in many respects during parts of this case. I'm not sure writing a letter or sending, you know, a card in the mail would necessarily have the same impact as it would on an older child. In this particular matter, by Mr. Valdez's own admission, there was only two phone calls arranged for my client to have contact with the child. And, you know, one of the other parts of Mr. Valdez, you know, he himself indicated that even knowing when my client was incarcerated, whether it was in jail or in prison, only reached out to my client on three or four separate occasions. And that's where I think my client takes issue with the reasonable efforts. When you look at, and the case plan in this case was originally drafted during the initial stages of the case, I believe even when it was on a voluntary basis before the CHIPS matter was actually started, and then it was never updated to take into account my client's changed circumstances. Obviously, when somebody's incarcerated, they have a much more limited access to services as when they are on the outside.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I kind of follow up Judge Berkey's question. The court, and I'm looking at finding of fact 74, where it was summarizing Mr. Valdez's extensive reasonable efforts to reunify the family, including the following. And it's simply a long paragraph that goes into a number of things that had been offered for your client and I assume actually to both parents at that time. My question for you, Mr. Thompson, in follow-up of Judge Werke's point, it seemed like the court did put emphasis on the few times your client was not in jail and or in prison, and there was about a 4 or 5 month period there in early 2019 in which your client had already been aware of the plan, and a big part of that was the chemical dependency issue and the psychosexual evaluation. And there was a number of findings, and based on Mr. Valdez's testimony and I believe other social workers, that he was adamantly opposed to doing both. Now, ultimately, I understand in jail, he may have gotten the Rule 25 chemical assessment, but isn't the main point, Mr. Thompson, that, and the law would support this, that it's a two-way street. When efforts are made, of course, your client would need to show a willingness to take part in those. And the court made some findings that both prior, early on when the stop occurred and the early discussions that Mr. Valdez and other social workers had, and then also during that 4 or 5 month period in which many of those efforts that are made and noted in finding of fact 74, that your client made absolutely no effort. I think you conceded that. Isn't it important for a court and for our court to give discretion to those sorts of findings which includes incarceration as a factor, not as a basis, but as a factor, together with what he did or didn't do when he was able to do them.
Well, Judge, I cannot argue against the fact that, you know, these appeals are discretionary and are based on the discretion of the trial court. And in going back to the earlier comment where it's an extremely uphill battle, that is 100% correct. I mean, there is no doubt that these appeals are extremely difficult for the appellant after the district court trial. And Mr. Lockwee and I have had that discussion on a number of different occasions. But, you know, when you're looking at these findings, I will acknowledge that in some respects, it's a two-way street. If the social services makes the offer and the party refuses to cooperate, there's not really a whole lot else that social services can do. However, there was a point in time, and, you know, because these cases take a long time to go to trial, where once Mr. Lockwee was incarcerated, there's no question that on some levels, we all know that that potentially forces sobriety. And one point I do want to make, Judge, and I apologize, but I do believe Mr. Lockwee has deserved this. He's in a much different position than he is right now. And part of that relies upon, you know, the palpable unfitness statute and whether or not for the foreseeable future, Mr. Lockwee would not be in a position to parent his child. Obviously, there's no set time frame for what that is as defined by the law. Mr. Lockwee is set to be out and released in September of 2022. And I just wanted the court to know, I know it has no weight on this appeal, but I do believe Mr. Lockwee is owed this. He's in a much different position he is right now, both with his sobriety, his mental health, all of those issues. And I just wanted him to hear that and the Court of Appeals to hear that. But in getting back to your point, Your Honor, I agree with you that there has to be a two-way street. But at a certain point, when Mr. Lockwee became a resident of the Department of Corrections, his street became a lot more narrow as to what he was allowed to do.
Also, I would like to talk a little bit about that period of time. And I appreciate your point about where your client is now, but while he was in prison, the district court found in finding 64 that Mr. Valdez followed up with jail staff about services, and due to appellant's behavior while in jail, programming was not available to him. That's the finding of the district court. Are you arguing that that finding was clearly erroneous?
No, Judge. I believe there's a distinction there. That was while he was at the St. Louis County Jail.
Okay.
Not when he became a resident of the Department of Corrections and was committed to prison following being in jail and his criminal issues resolving. And so I think that's where the distinction is made. While in jail, you know, the services are limited, and two, it would be based upon where he was at and whether or not he would be amenable to those services. So I am not arguing that that is clearly erroneous.
Thank you for that clarification. I'd like to turn just briefly to the best interest determination because time is running short. Your brief doesn't appear to address the child's need for a safe and stable environment in as part of the best interest determination. Are you arguing that the district court abused its discretion when it concluded that any interest in preserving the parent-child relationship was clearly outweighed by the need for a safe and stable environment?
So it's a tricky question, Judge. One, I don't think anybody could dispute that a child needs a safe and stable environment. So I think that is 100% clear and unarguable. I think when it comes to what's in the best interest factor and what needs to be looked at there is that it seems like when I've done these appeals or even as an attorney doing child protection, one of the issues is whether or not they factor in anything other than the parent themselves. Mr. Lockwea is obviously in a position where he's in prison. He's had his own issues, but Mr. Lockwea's relationship being terminated also terminates everybody else in the family, including siblings, including other family members. Those types of things also need to be balanced. And I don't believe that that was actually done here in this particular case. It was an extremely narrow view of, let's look at Mr. Lockwea, take the strict meaning of the language. And I don't think that that's necessarily what anybody would intend, because just like I can't argue against a safe, stable environment, I don't think anybody can argue that a parent-child relationship goes farther than just a parent and a child. It goes to grandparents, aunts, uncles, siblings. All of that is also taken into definition when it comes to family, which is obviously the biggest issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. And so if counsel for respondent, if you would identify yourself for the record, you may proceed.
Morning. I'm Jennifer Berry, attorney for St. Louis County Public Health and Human Services. May it please the court and counsel, since the paramount consideration in any child protection matter is the child's best interest, I would like to start with that discussion. It is my contention that the record is ample with findings that the termination is in the child's best interest. After applying the balancing tests, it's clear that any of Mr. Lockwea's interest in preserving the parent-child relationship are nominal at best. The trivialization of any cards, contact notes, gifts, acknowledgement of the child, both in letters and writing, would be the only way the appellant would have the ability to contact the child during his periods of incarceration, given both the COVID restrictions and his own voluntary criminal behavior, which led to him being held in jurisdictions, including Wisconsin, Hennepin County, St. Louis County, and multiple facilities within the Department of Corrections.
That being the case, Ms. Berry, as Mr. Thompson argued, somebody has to help him do that if he's incarcerated. You know, you need to know the address, you need to have that information. And just a point I want to have clarified as to whether in fact he was provided with necessary information as to how he would have that limited contact with this child.
He was, Your Honor. Mr. Valdez made clear both in court hearings that Mr. Lockwea attended and in conversations with him that he would provide the conduit for the passing of any such information. I know the guardian ad litem made clear at every hearing she appeared in that that was her expectation. In fact, I believe that Mr. Valdez did send pictures, and Mr. Valdez also did tell the appellant how the child was doing, despite the appellant not making any inquiry into the child's well-being. I believe that it was Mr. Valdez's information passing to the appellant, not the other way. So it would have been available to him, and it was made clear to him. Also, the relationship before Mr. Lockwea was incarcerated was tenuous at best, and often resulted in dysregulation of the child. There was no identification of Mr. Lockwea as the father at that point. The appellant did have opportunity to see the child in person, and by his own behavior, that in-person contact was ceased. And there was, again, not even a basic inquiry into the child's well-being, either by the appellant or, as Mr. Thompson indicated, the appellant's family. I will note that there was an extensive relative search done before the child was placed with the current permanency option, and all of the family that was provided by the appellant was found to be inappropriate and not an appropriate placement for the child based on having had significant issues with child protection or criminal history. The child's
Ms. Berry, Can I inquire about Mr. Valdez? You referenced Mr. Valdez in his testimony. He did admit, I believe on cross-examination, that he should have modified the placement plan, the plan once father went into prison. And so I'm curious what your thought is on how we view that. And he also admitted, I believe, in cross-examination, he should have had more visits with him, et cetera. From an appellate review, what do we make of that testimony and that evidence in the record?
So one of the things about the plan being changed was, as again, it was the appellant's own behavior that led to the difficulty, and even if the plan had been changed to reflect the current circumstances, services were unavailable to him given his own behavior, given the COVID pandemic, and given his hopping around. So even if the plan had been changed, there would have been even less in there. I think the appellate court, obviously, as indicated, the best interest is the overriding standard. And testimony was clear that even if Mr. Lockway were to be released to say or have an appropriate plan, that that would require extensive services beyond even what he was able to do in prison, given that the child did not have any relationship with him. And the guardian did testify to requiring any therapeutically guided contact, even any contact at that point, given utter lack of relationship between the child and appellant. And so even if the plan had been changed, it would not have been accomplishable at that point. And again, it's the child's need for stability and permanency. And there was testimony indicating that the child does have special needs. This uncertainty of finalization is having an impact on the child, that the child has a loving relationship with the foster family and the foster family's extended family, and that the appellant made no effort whatsoever to learn about this child and her special needs.
Counsel, you would agree, though, that the best interest determination is not the only determination that the court needs to make. It also needs to find that one or more of the statutory grounds for termination have been met. So in this case, which of the statutory grounds found by the district court is, in your view, is the strongest ground for termination?
Your Honor, I believe the subdivision regarding the child being neglected in foster care, I believe that's comprehensive of all of the work that was done by the agency throughout the entirety of this case, and also touches on the reasonable efforts made and the court's finding. Appellant's absolute failure to correct any of the conditions, including a lifelong adult history of criminal behavior, and particularly no relationship with the child. I believe that the court had basis for all of the other statutes, including that he substantially, continuously, and repeatedly refused or neglected to comply with any of the duties of parenthood. I think the court made substantial findings regarding his behavior both during the voluntaries and during his incarceration, and that it would take issue with it being reasonably foreseeable for a child who's 3 and a half that her father will be released in what is approximately 11 months. And I think that his pattern under the probably unfit has been clear. He's had significant child protection history related to other children, including permanency of both of those cases, resulting in one that was a transfer to tribal court and one that was a transfer of custody to his father, that there's nearly 5 pages of findings by the district court as to this finding that there is a pattern. And again, under the totality of circumstances, that it weighs both this child's best interest and the statutory basis are met. I think that the no meaningful contact cannot be ignored, even when he did have opportunity to, that this child doesn't know who the appellant is and has no basis for a relationship and given the child's age, that the need for permanency outweighs any of the concerns that the agency had in changing a plan and or being able to meet with the client while incarcerated. I would also like to address the fact that the appellant did not address any of the sexual abuse findings that he had against minor family members, and that being a significant concern of the district court, that he had ample opportunity to do that before he was incarcerated, and that obviously was a significant concern both for the court and social services regarding the appellant's ability to provide safety for this child. And in fact, he was often asking that the minor victims themselves come forward to recant as opposed to addressing the issues at hand, despite social services repeated attempts at having him complete a psychosexual. The district court did rely heavily on that. He did not complete that, and that would be a significant concern. And obviously, incarcerated, he would have limited ability to do that, again, given the situation, his multiple moving around, and the COVID situation. And that specifically could have been addressed before he went into prison.
Ms. Berry, with regard to reasonable efforts, would you agree that the district court in its finding 99, I believe it's 99, had made the statement reasonable efforts are not required as they would be futile and unrealistic under the circumstances? That's the first mention I see in the order, and the last mention I see in reference to that. Would you agree that was an error by the court in making that finding slash conclusion? And if so, what do we make of that in part of our evaluation?
I do. I think that the court did indicate that based on his pattern of history, that he was palpably unfit and that reasonable circumstance or reasonable efforts were not required. However, I think the record is replete that reasonable efforts were made. And I think in the court's findings, as indicated previously, I believe it was 74, that there were significant reasonable efforts made, that there is reasonable under the circumstances. Mr. Valdez did indicate a difficulty in tracking the client, again, based on appellants moving around and based on the COVID-19 pandemic, which the court does reference in its order. I don't know if there would have been a different outcome had he gone not more than he did, given the circumstances, because from the appellant's standpoint, I don't know when enough would be enough as far as efforts would. I think it's already been addressed that he did provide a conduit for the child and the appellant to have contact. I think that the court can find, despite that finding, that there were reasonable efforts made, that this, again, is in weight with the best interest of the child, which I've already addressed.
Any final comments you wish to make? You have a little over 2.5 minutes remaining, Ms. Berry.
I think the focus on parents is obviously important, as they would be the reunification parents. But in this case, I don't think that the appellant made even any significant attempts to have a relationship with the child before imprisonment, and certainly has had none since imprisonment. I think that the child's needs are such that there's a well-documented history of her needs being met and exceeded, and the loving relationship that the child has with the foster family and the extended family certainly on balance outweighs any deficiencies of the record, Your Honor.
Very well, thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Your Honors, I don't think I'll need the entire 5 minutes unless you have some specific questions for me, but I do want to make two quick points. One, and the problem with being incarcerated, especially being part of the Department of Corrections since COVID hit, was that it did limit the number of services that were available to inmates. However, there was an added benefit in that, like, video calls have been readily available to people who are incarcerated at this point in time, because they needed to make up for the ability for, or the inability for people to come into the prisons and actually have face-to-face prison time. And so when counsel talks about, you know, the limited video or contact, part of that would have been defined by, you know, social services setting up those video calls so that he could have had contact with the child. In addition, one of the specific services that the county wanted was a psychosexual evaluation. And I know that that could have been arranged by social services. That is something that they could have had done while he was incarcerated with the Department of Corrections. And that would have been, you know, potentially the answer that they were looking for. I also want the court just to note that those were maltreatment findings, which has a much lower burden of proof than the clear and convincing evidence required for a child protection and a termination of parental rights. The burden in a maltreatment finding is a preponderance of the evidence and is a much lower burden. And so I hope the appellate court, when reviewing, gives that the weight that it should, because this district court didn't have any other evidence other than those specific findings. There was really no testimony presented on those particular issues other than the findings or the maltreatment findings themselves. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very well. Appears to be no other questions, so we appreciate the comments by both counsel and the briefing in the matter. We will take the matter under advisement in an expedited fashion because of the child protection nature of this proceeding. You each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.